How can a conversation heard, say, on the radio be of service to democracy? Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The United States is experiencing its first significant and prolonged decline in press freedom in modern history. That's according to the latest World Press Freedom Index. That's a report published by Reporters Without Borders. And the defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is part of that overall story. Jen White is host of 1A. It's a show that airs weekly at 9 a.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB. I talked with her about the power of local journalism. This has been a really challenging year for public media, of course, but also for journalism in general. And you've done a lot of thought on this and guided conversations and been at the Aspen Ideas Festival. And so I'm kind of curious to know what some of your key takeaways are of 2025 about the role of public media or 1A as a show, or even journalism right now. What are some big things that you think you'll take away as you recap the year?
A few things come to mind. And first is the value of reliable information. There is a lot of information available to us right now through different social media apps, the internet. There's so many different platforms, but reliable information, it feels like there's less of that available these days. Yeah. And that is not good for us individually. It's not good for our communities. It's certainly not good for our democracy. And specific to public radio, especially with the cut in funding from the federal government and the way that disproportionately impacts stations in rural areas, areas that are already underserved when it comes to local journalism, I'm deeply concerned about the direct impact on communities that lose access to what might be their last source of local news.
Yeah.
And so my hope is that more stations will find a path forward, a sustainable path forward, because you know and I know, when local news disappears, people become less engaged in their communities. The data bears that out. They become less engaged in the public sphere. The data bear that out. And what we need at this moment in our country is not less engagement. We need deeper engagement. We need more meaningful engagement.
And I'm wondering if you could speak, when you talk about deeper engagement and more meaningful engagement, one of the trends that I've noticed in the journalism that I read online is an increase in sources who are not named because they're not authorized to speak. When I do an interview, when you do an interview, people pretty much have to show up as themselves and have a longer, deeper conversation with us. What's the role of a talk show, of a long-form conversation, in this moment when there might be a time and a place for an unnamed source? But what's the role of getting people around the microphone and saying, we're going to talk about this, and the thing that we're going to talk about is going to be really complicated and hard, but we're going to show up and do it?
Yeah. I think part of it is just having the space to have those discussions. Yeah. Again, in this onslaught of information, things move so quickly, and there's this push to try to encapsulate something that's incredibly complex in two or three sentences. And I think that's a disservice to both the story and to the listener or the reader. And so having an hour when we can sit down and hash it out together and leave space for listeners' questions or their stories as they connect to what we're discussing, there's so few places where you have that kind of space.
Yeah.
And so it's about granting any given topic the space it deserves, but also allowing people to engage in the conversation and to engage with one another. So you get comments from people in Michigan and Florida and California and Washington State. And suddenly you have a discussion happening among Americans in a way that's really difficult to convene these days. I think that's invaluable.
So how important is it for you on 1A when people from South Dakota say, call in or send in comments to be part of that conversation? What does that mean for you and your team?
Everything. Everything. We the shows when I am most excited, because I pay a lot of attention to listener engagement, is when there is great geographical diversity in what we're hearing from listeners. Whether it's through the call-in shows or through the emails we're receiving or our text messages, when people say proudly, I'm, you know, Julie from this city or this small town, I think it both conveys this sense of connection that's too often missing in the discussions we have around the news. But it also shows me that interest in any given topic or any given issue, you're not interested necessarily because you're in a particular part of the country. You're interested because you are a member of a larger community that cares about what's happening to everyone in the country, right? So just because it's a South Dakota story doesn't mean it shouldn't matter to someone in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Our fates are tied together. So we have to be in conversation with one another.
I feel like 1A does this in a very unique way, but this I could speak a long time about the importance of local journalism, and so could you, but it's also a national show that incorporates, you don't fly in and fly out, you incorporate voices and follow up. But I'm wondering, in what ways do you as a journalist, either from your work as a local journalist to your work on 1A as a national voice and leader in the industry, find ways to say, we are going to spotlight local voices, but we also want to know what you need from us. You know, how do you respond to the voices and the stories of the things that people matter about? So it's coming from that groundswell of people calling in. Do you see what I'm asking you there?
Yeah. There's a central tenet of our program. It's called Nothing About Us Without Us. Mm-hmm. And so if we're talking about a community, then that community needs to be part of the discussion. And so if we're talking about a story in South Dakota, we're not going to reach out to a paper on the East Coast to say, hey, what do your reporters think about this thing?
Yeah.
We're going to reach out to local journalists in South Dakota and say, what can you tell us? Do you want to be a part of the discussion? Can you connect us to people in your community who you think should be part of this discussion? We want to elevate your work. We have a series on the program called Local Spotlight that is specifically focused on bringing local investigative journalism to the national stage. I think that's incredibly important because we tend to exist in these media bubbles, and we have to better understand that there are stories that connect all of us. It may be happening in Washington State, but it also matters to someone in Washington, D.C. There actually may be connections between the stories.
Yeah.
And so we're deeply committed to bringing local voices to local stories, not this sort of, you know, parachute in approach to covering stories that are in your community.
Jen White is the host of 1A. Listen weekdays at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain on SDPB. Now let's check in with Andrew Limbong. He is a reporter for NPR's Arts Desk. He joins us for an update on the NPR Annual Interactive Reading Guide. It is called NPR's Books We Love.
We do this every year, I think since 2013. And what we do is we ask everyone at NPR what their favorite books of the year were. And when I say everyone, it's not just, you know, people on the book staff. It's not just our critics, although they're obviously included too, but it's literally everybody who works at NPR. So you got producers and editors, you got people in like the business side of NPR who are just like chipping in. And that way we cast a wide net. And so this year, I think there are about 380, like in that neighborhood, books on the list. And even though I know that number sounds daunting, but the sort of scale of it is kind of the point. There are these tags on the side that help you narrow down which book you want. They kind of act as like filters. So if you want something, a nonfiction book that's short, or a fantasy book that has a lot of sex in it, which I guess that's you can find all that pretty easily. But
That's a
with that's
specific,
also for you. Yeah. So it just really helps you pin down exactly what you want, or if you're shopping for somebody else, what the reader in your life might be into.
what strikes you as the trends or the themes of this year and what people have been reading?
I haven't done like a sophisticated data analysis of the
Right,
books,
yeah.
but I was kind of surprised at the amount of like crime thrillers that were on the list
Okay.
this year. There was a lot of like, somewhat violence, crime novels. There's the Ninth Slow Horses book by Mick Herron, so called Clown Town. That book is on the list. I'm thinking of a book like King of Ashes by S.A. Cosby. That's a Southern Gothic crime fiction book about a family in rural Virginia who owns a crematorium that gets roped into a sort of a drug criminal ring.
Okay.
So a lot of these like very fun pulpy crime books made the list.
And you've been also doing this project with the limited podcast Books We Love, which makes me want to know what you're learning about which books endure and show up in our lives throughout our lifetimes.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, this is the podcast that we've been doing, just talking about older books, and sort of what I wanted to do is throw back to a time when books had this kind of massive cultural cachet. Not to say that they don't have punching power now, but they used to really be able to change and shape the culture in a way they kind of like have lost that footing, right? And I think revisiting some books, it's interesting. I just recorded an episode on Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, right? And I remember reading that book at 15, and I got a leather jacket. I started smoking cigarettes. I started, cursing. When you're 15, you're 15, you're very impressionable. And it like turned me into a kind of guy. And reading that now as an adult, knowing, seeing what's going on in that book through more like, it's kind of messed up that you're treating people that way. Or it's like, it's a weird way to
There's a
act at work.
yeah.
That's not to say it's still I still say I think it's a fabulous book based on the writing alone, on his strength and his voice, on his strength as a writer. But it has been interesting to especially revisit books that had a profound effect on you. Maybe you just like haven't picked them up in a while.
One of the books on the Books We Love guide, Baldwin, A Love Story. I picked this one up too because, man, it is beautiful book design.
Oh
Like,
yeah.
wow,
Yeah. Are
that
you done with it? It's a
no,
chunky, dude.
no,
Yeah, it's like 600, 700 pages, right?
It's a big, thick book, but beautifully designed. So I picked it up and I haven't started it yet. Now I see it on somebody else's choice. I'm even more encouraged to go in and read it.
Yeah, well, it came in handy because so on the podcast Books We've Loved, we talked about James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room. In Baldwin, A Love Story, the Nicholas Boggs biography, he goes through what Baldwin was going through relationship wise at the time. The sort of he was I don't think it's unfair to say he was a messy dude. He was like falling in and out of love. He was breaking hearts left and right, and you can and that fed into his work. And so it's been interesting. It was an interesting companion to have along with rereading Giovanni's Room.
Here's a title from the fiction list, which I feel like we cannot ignore: Sex of the Midwest. I've not heard of this title yet. Are we going to stay away from that in the Midwest, or are we all going to order it tomorrow? I don't
No,
know.
so that's a book by Robin Ryle. It's a sort of a short story cycle where a survey about sex sort of gets sent around a small town, and it causes, pearls to be clutched and some salacious, it's like, ooh, what's going on there? But I think, the author was on NPR talking about a book, and she was saying something about how people have a weird tendency to assume that people in small towns don't lead interesting sex lives. It's like a weird stereotype that's like, oh, these are just like boring family people that I don't know, like the assumptions like what they just like sleep in separate beds or something, like an I Love Lucy or something. It's like, no, these are human beings with weird quirks that we all have, and so I think that was a big selling point for the book.
NPR's Books We Love includes more than 380 books personally recommended by members of the NPR staff. Well, I want to hear about the books that you love. Send me an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Tell me your favorite book of 2025. That's our conversation for today. I hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.